I was at Gary's the other day. Speaking of Luigi's Mansion, he has a piece of video game chotch that is, I think, the best piece of video game chotch I've ever seen.
Oh?
Which is a Luigi's Mansion desk light that has Luigi and the ghost dog and the goo pack. And there's like three different kinds of lights on it. And it actually looks sculpted and really good. Wow. And it captures the
It's not just some cheesy, like it doesn't have the logo of the game silk screened on the lampshade.
It does
it's
not.
Like it actually
there's
looks
no
like
lampshade. It's just a statue that lights up and the ghost lights up enough to be like kind of a, it would be a bad desk light, but it's like an ambient light.
When you say chotch, does it have to have been a freebie for promotional purposes or could it be bought? Could it be a store bought thing? Cause I don't know if that qualifies as chotch. I've never heard the term chotch before.
It's short.
It's short for. I've just never heard anybody truncate it that way.
That's how I always try. This might be a me thing.
Sounds gross when you say it.
It is gross. It's a gross. So I asked Gary where he got it. He said he got it from Greg Miller. And I don't know whether it's like the premium pack in.
Okay. It could
like
be.
If you bought the super edition, you got that.
Yeah.
Or if it was like something they sent out to press.
Okay.
But it is.
That sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah. It's really good.
I'm going to have to Google Luigi lamp after this.
Yeah.
I don't know if that can compete with the Grand Theft Auto Vice City Coke mirror.
Wait, what?
That I saw at Ryan's house one time.
They sent a Coke mirror?
They put out, yes, it's literally a Coke mirror with a Vice City logo in the corner that they sent out.
Was it Saints Row 3 that sent the dildo bat?
Was that 4? Yes, I believe that was 3.
Yeah.
Perhaps the less said about that, the better.
That was, yeah, you're right. I don't know. The Coke mirror, I think, is worse than the dildo bat.
It's an inspired piece of promotion.
Welcome.
Hi.
To thanks, another episode of Brad Hill Made a Tech Pod. Hello.
So kind of you to invite me to this podcast.
I'm not having you. I'm in your house.
That's true.
We closed the curtains this week, so it's less echoey.
Do we co-own this? Do we both have equal claim to this podcast?
I guess Brad and Will made a tech pod. Okay. There's no...
Our names are both in the title.
Right. I mean, we could replace you with another Brad.
That's true.
Or you could replace me with another Will.
Yeah.
Another
Will Smith, in fact.
Look, there's plenty.
What do you think Will Smith's NAS is running? The other Will Smith.
Oh, he's probably got like some.
You think he's probably running like Raid Z2. I bet he's big on redundancy.
No, man.
Right?
Look, he's got like a home installer business. Like he spent $100,000 getting the Malibu mansion outfitted with like. It's probably just a shitload of TiVos though. At this point,
he insisted on Cat 6 to every room.
Cat 6,
for sure.
Yeah, nothing that no plenum
for sure.
No plenum.
Yeah.
Brad?
Yes?
It's that most special time of month.
Huh?
It's the time of month when we take questions.
That's right. In the form of emails.
That are sent to techpod@content.town, mm-hmm. The internet's number one technology podcast resource destination.
The most informed, authoritative.
Yes. We've read most of these.
Of tech talkers on the internet.
Yeah. We've been doing this for 2 × 10⁻²⁰ at this point,
I think.
So,
Got these emails in front of me.
Yeah, what you got?
Our filtering process was basically scroll through the emails and figure out if we had something to say about each one of them.
That is as good a place as any to start.
Whether it's a definitive answer or not is up to the listener.
Look, sometimes we have thoughts, sometimes we have questions.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. First email came from Joe in New York.
Hi, Joe.
I was thinking of replacing my Vive with an Index, but I'm not sure if it's worth the $1,000 plus tax and shipping.
Hmm.
I read that the Index headset and controllers work with the original Vive base stations. In that case, is it even worth getting the entire Index set? Is the jump in resolution from the Vive to the Index worth the money? Because the reduction in, besides the reduction in screen door effect, is there any other benefit to the Index headset? Ultimately, I do want the controllers. They seem really cool and come with Half-Life Alyx. Should I save myself some money and just get the headset and controllers, or should I just get the controllers?
So
there's a lot of questions.
There's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
First off, I recently went with Norm at Tested to Valve to play Half-Life Alyx.
You played that thing.
On a whole shitload of different VR headsets.
Wow.
So the reason they asked us to come up and try the game on Index and then also everything else that they're supporting, which is basically like Windows MR,
Oculus,
original Oculus Rift, new Oculus Rift S, Oculus Quest with the link cable.
Do you think that game will run on the, what was the dev, the CV? No.
It will not run on the CV1, I don't think.
CV1, was that the original, that was the prototype?
Yeah, I don't think Oculus supports CV1 anymore.
Valve's really fallen down on the job.
No. CV1 is the release. RC.
DK?
DK2. DK2?
That was the
first one with the camera.
That would probably stand for dev
game. Yeah.
Valve, I thought they were supporting every headset, but
Look, man, they're just trying to keep Facebook down.
Shame.
So
yeah, what do you want to discuss the? So yeah, this is his first big question. His actionable item here is it really worth getting an Index, or if you already have a Vive?
So the answer to that is it depends. If you don't have if you didn't get the Pro Audio strap for the Vive, the original Vive with the rubber band head gasket and like your own headphones is pretty uncomfortable for long term play. And the other thing is they're not making those Pro Audio head straps anymore. So, and the market for them has gone up dramatically because people are Frankensteining them onto Quests to make the Quest more comfortable. So if you don't already have the Pro Audio strap, it may be worth upgrading just for comfort. The other option is the Vive Pro, which is a lot more expensive than the same price as the Index, basically, and doesn't have the higher. So when you upgrade from the Vive to the Index, you get the slightly higher refresh resolution, which means that you have less screen door and you can actually read text in the headset. So if you want to do stuff like run a virtual desktop in your VR and have windows all over the place and get crazy, you can totally do that with the Index or the Vive Pro. The big thing that the Index offers, the headset offers, in addition to comfort, which the headset's really comfortable, the speakers that are on the side that mount, they're not like on-ear speakers, they're kind of off-ear, but they focus the sound into your ears in a really, really good way, are the best that I've used.
Wow.
After using a bunch of stuff side by side, they're very clearly better than everybody else.
Huh, okay.
The refresh rate is a big deal. So higher refresh rate, if you have a PC that can drive 144 hertz in the headset or 120 hertz in the headset versus 90, if you're susceptible to motion sickness, it's much less effective.
Oh, does that really help?
It helps.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now the controllers, if you have a Vive with the Pro Audio strap, I would just buy the controllers and be done.
So they do sell the controllers by themselves?
They sell the controllers by themselves. They sell the headset by itself. They sell the lighthouses by themselves.
Oh, wow. That's nice of them.
And the compatibility matrix for that stuff is that the original Vive will work with Lighthouse 1. The Index will work with the launch Vive lighthouses. The Vive Pro will work with the launch Vive lighthouses. The original Vive does not work with the Lighthouse 2.0s that come with Index.
Okay.
So you have to have a Vive Pro Knuckles controllers or Vive Pro controllers or an Index to work with the Lighthouse 2.0.
The upshot sounds like to go out there and do your research and make sure you know what you have and what works with what.
Yeah.
Before you buy anything.
Also, you can just buy the Index headset and the controllers and use those with the old lighthouses and they're fine.
Okay.
The benefit of the new lighthouses is mostly for people like what I do at Foo or like installers and stuff like that, because you can put more than two lighthouses in a space, which normal people aren't going to do.
Right.
So,
yes.
So yeah, I think the big takeaway from, we spent like 4 hours playing the game, three or four hours playing the game, and then a whole day testing a bunch of different headsets. And the takeaway is that the Vive Wands, the ones that shipped with the original Vive, are, I think, the worst controls for playing the game. Like, it works and you can play it and it's fun.
Okay.
But not having kind of, the grip is fiddly. Like, those grip buttons are bad on those initial Vive Wands. So having either a physical button that you press on the Oculus controllers, the Windows MR controllers, or having the analog touch controls with the knuckles, the Index controllers, makes a big difference in the game.
Okay.
I think makes it a lot more fun.
So a fair number of substantial upgrades, it sounds like, but also it's not a cheap upgrade. So.
It is not a cheap, like it's the difference between $300 for the controllers alone, maybe $100. If you have to pay more than $100 to get a Pro Audio strap, don't do that.
Yeah. On the other hand, how often does a new Half-Life game come out in VR? So if you really want the optimal experience for that, it sounds like there are advantages to trading up.
I mean, we played on a Samsung Windows MR headset that used the like the normal touchpad and sticks. Like the big things that were important from a control standpoint were being able to separate. And of course, it's all uses Steam's controller stuff. So you can bind whatever you want, whatever verbs you want in the game to whatever buttons you want on the controllers. Using their default configurations as they were when we tested a couple weeks ago, the having the weapon select and the quick turns on different controls. So you know, with VR, especially if you're using one of the headsets like the original Rift that has to face forward, you have quick turns on one stick usually that'll flip you 30 or 45 or 90 degrees one way or the other. And on the Rift, you had to click down on the stick to select weapon select.
Yeah.
Also the twitch and the flipping turn. To the side yeah, to did the turn.
That sounds awkward.
So you would often hit the button and turn and get disoriented, yeah. Which wasn't ideal. Having like on the Windows MR things that had the touchpad, on the Knuckles, which have the touchpad, on something else had a touchpad.
The newer Oculus controllers?
No, or? The Oculus controllers are always a stick.
Even the newest ones?
Yeah.
Okay.
But the point is you're going to want to bind those two things to something else.
Okay. Yo, what's up with that game?
It's dope. Okay. It's really good.
Cool.
The gravity gloves mean you don't end up stooping and stuff as much. So like you can look at something and kind of like force pull them over to you and then catch it.
That's great.
It is very satisfying to throw stuff at things. I hope the part of the game that we saw at the very beginning, like you don't offensively throw things at people. I hope that stuff comes in later in the game because it was so fucking fun to just grab a brick and huck it at somebody.
Can the gloves launch objects or just pull them to you?
So when you launch by throwing.
Okay.
But
is there any added force beyond your throw? Like, do they add extra push to it? Not at
the point that we had seen.
Okay. Maybe more of like a late game upgrade.
Look, there's a history of late game upgrades that make the gravity weapons into unstoppable killing machines.
Yeah.
It was the thing that was neat playing it more than anything else was playing a game that had like AAA art put into VR.
I've come to realize that's really all I care about with this thing.
Yeah.
Even if it doesn't really innovate in terms of VR mechanics too much.
It's
there just haven't been that many games out there with that level of production value thrown at them in VR.
Well, and there's a lot of stuff that comes with that. That's like them clearly trying to make something that's a showcase. So there's a lot of like little side paths to kind of explore. Okay. It's the part that we saw was pretty linear. Like the combat arenas open up a little bit, but the exploration-y parts are basically like you finding your way through a maze, just like Half-Life has always been. They did multiple forms of locomotion. So like you could do the normal Valve teleport where you push forward and like rotate the stick to you know have the determine what orientation you face when you land. They also had smooth locomotion. The internet nerds got really upset about not having like ladder climbing like in Boneworks where you physically use your hand and climb up the ladder.
Grab the rungs.
That makes almost everybody I've seen do that sick.
Okay.
The things that they did do really well, like there was they didn't take control of the camera from the player. So there was at no point did the camera move without my head moving, which is key to not making people throw. Like,
yes.
They made this game to be accessible to people who have never played VR before.
Okay.
The other thing was the gun reload stuff it's so satisfying.
That's good. Okay.
Yeah.
The last thing I was going to ask is I feel like the one moment most people I know picked up on or really were impressed by in that trailer is like digging around on the shelf to find ammo. Like, it doesn't seem like that is a mechanic that's represented a lot. Or, I mean, are you interacting with the environment a lot in ways like that?
I opened a lot of drawers and there's ammo on top of things on the reg. Like when you smash crates, there's ammo and stuff inside the crates. They have the old Half-Life boxes with the yellow label on top. It's a little grungier now. There's peanuts inside the box. Huh. So when you smash open the box, it's just like a little bit of ammo and a whole shitload of packing peanuts.
Oh, that sounds fun.
It's opening drawers. I haven't had as much fun opening drawers as I did like when the last time I played Skyrim.
Strong endorsement.
Yeah.
Best drawer opening.
Well, it's all one-to-one. You just pull your arm back and you open those drawers, man.
Best in class drawers. That's great.
I'm excited about playing. I left and I was ready to play more.
That's
cool. After playing it for 10 hours over 2 days.
That's good to hear. That's cool. All right. Next email is from Brian in Culver City. Why is there never a queue to watch the new season of Stranger Things or The Mandalorian like there are when a new Call of Duty launches? Is it simply less concurrent users?
No, it's way more concurrent users probably.
Yeah, when I first read this email, I was like, God, there must be, well, Call of Duty might be an outlier because it's so popular.
But even then,
like streaming video is so ubiquitous at this point, it has to be like almost an order of magnitude in some cases.
Like if you think about a big live stream event, like the State of the Union, or I don't know, what's something that's huge on YouTube that millions of people stream? I mean, I know I'm completely blanking, inauguration, stuff like that. Sure. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
So,
or even like with something like a Netflix, it doesn't have to be everybody watching the same show all at one time. It's just the number of people using the service.
Right. Well, so, okay. So the TLDR is we're really good at delivering files over the internet now. Cause at the end of the day, all a streamed video on Netflix is an H.264 video file.
Right.
That like is just, you know, linked to a web page.
You're really just downloading the video, right? It displays and then disappears into the ether when it's done instead of being saved somewhere.
Well, and streaming, but like streaming a live event is a little bit different because that's more like streaming Game 7 of the World Series is difficult because like latency matters and like they can't slip frames and fall back in time or else you'll get out of sync with everybody else that's watching and bitching about the game on Twitter. So
that becomes obvious pretty quickly.
Yeah. Or like in my neighborhood, you like when there's Warriors games on, we know if Hulu is behind because the fireworks go off in the neighborhood
before the game is over.
Yeah. So, like it's just a video file. Whereas with Call of Duty, they have, if they assume that there's going to be 50,000 people playing or 100,000 people or a million people playing at any moment, then they have to have that many virtual servers. And it's easy, like, if you think about like WoW launch timeframe when the queues were 3,000 people deep and like they didn't have enough physical servers for all the people that bought the game, it's a little bit different now because there's cloud infrastructure for spinning up servers, but it still takes time.
And it's a different kind of network interaction. It's not a one way stream of data to your house. It's a back and forth. Like you're constantly having to communicate with the server in both directions.
Well, and the server has to have like CPU and memory allocated per user.
Right.
Or probably per server, like if you think about something like Call of Duty, they're probably running multiple game servers on each virtual server in a cloud. But still, it's like there's cost and stuff associated with that. There's amount of CPU allocated per user, and it's, I mean, basically there's whole teams that work on those big live multiplayer games that do nothing but figure out how to make the server infrastructure dynamic. And then when on launch day, it rolls out and there's a queue, it means that having a million people hit it at once has found some bottleneck that they didn't anticipate or weren't able to test for. So then like the good example is the login server, right? Like if the game servers are set up to accommodate a million people at a time, but the login servers can't handle 100,000 people hitting them at any given moment, then the moment those servers go online, there's going to be a queue until the login server catches up.
Right.
Is all there is to it. And like on web servers, we've built a lot of infrastructure for delivering big files to the point that like your Netflix, your big files that are the Netflix videos don't live on Netflix's server in Hoboken, New Jersey, wherever the fuck Netflix is. They live.
Wait, I thought they were here.
Probably. It doesn't matter. Is the point
they have an office here?
Yeah, they live on a content distribution network that's located networkally close to your ISP. So that I just made up a word.
Networkical location.
The networkical location. But it's close to where your ISP is, so that they can deliver those files without having to do a bunch of hops over the internet.
Yes,
that's it.
Yes. Let's see. Kyle from Portland has an email. Brad has mentioned the 30-foot HDMI cable that he rolls out when he wants to run his PC out to his TV, and I'm trying to get the same kind of setup in my place. I have a powered USB cable that works well, but having some issues with the HDMI cable and the video signal. Right now, the video signal is dropping. The screen just goes black for a few seconds and then comes back on. This happens repeatedly. Did you run into any issues putting together your office to living room setup, and what are you currently using to make the setup work? Does that sound like a handshaking issue to you?
It sounds like power
or signal issue.
Signal. Usually HDMI is 5 meters or 3 meters, right?
I think so. Mine is 30 feet, which would be
6 meters.
Yes.
So did you buy a powered one?
Is that right?
Yeah. 30 feet divided by 3. No, 10 meters. Sorry.
Yeah, I thought it was 10. Cause it was 3 feet.
It's like roughly 9 point something.
Roughly 3 feet to a meter, right? Yeah. It's not powered, but I did. That was a consideration when I bought this cable. God, Saints Row the Third was the first PC game I played on it, if that tells you anything. So nine years ago?
So it's like HDMI 2 or
eight,
something.
8 years ago. It's an old cable. I got it from Monoprice, but I knew that signal strength was an issue over distance. So I took a gamble and just bought a very heavy gauge cable. I checked because I read this email before we came in here. I checked. It's a 22 gauge HDMI cable.
Wow, that's a chalker.
It's a thick ass cable.
Yeah. You're not hiding that thing.
And it worked. Like it's totally fine. Huh. Over 30 feet, I get zero signal problems.
Huh.
From end to end. I even
You're also only doing 1080p, not 4K.
Yes. Yes. I'm only pushing 1080 60.
Yeah.
Over that. So that's maybe a factor. I don't know.
Huh.
I'm even running it. It's going through. I bet it's going through four other HDMI or maybe five other HDMI junction points from PC to TV.
Oh, you have like splitters and
so
stuff.
So I bought, Monoprice, if you ever looked, has got a ton of interesting little like hinged and swiveling HDMI extenders.
Oh my. Like not powered, just physical adapters.
Yeah. Yeah. Just tiny little.
Oh my God.
And I got them specifically because that cable is such a heavy ass cable.
Yeah.
Having that cable hanging out of the back of the GPU or out of the video card seemed like a pretty bad idea for the integrity of that port.
Yeah.
Not to mention you might trip over it when it's going down the hole.
You yank it out. Yeah.
So it's on, I've got one coming out that is both hinged and swivel that comes out of the video card, which gives it both, it gives it flex and turn.
I'm amazed this works.
That is going to a very light gauge, like 6-inch extender down to the,
and then the big boy comes in.
The big
in.
One goes all the way down the hall. And then I've got like a 6-foot one coming out of the back of the receiver around, to meet it, with another one of those little, but point being like the signal, even with all that, the signal is, again, it's only at 1080 60, but it comes in nice and clean.
So I was going to say, if you have trouble with not making the distance, like you need to go further than you can with the length cable that you can do. You can always get like an HDMI splitter that is a powered one
yeah.
that lives in between not something designed to switch back and forth between two inputs, which doesn't have to have any logic at all, but something that physically takes one signal, an HDMI signal, makes it two, and you can plug those in midway down the course and you can do 2 15-foot runs and have no problems.
And that shouldn't introduce any extra latency or anything like that.
It might add it a little bit, but
yeah,
like you're not
negligible.
Realistically, I'm not playing fighting games in my living room.
Yeah.
Or if I am, I'm probably playing on a console.
Probably like single digit milliseconds, if I had to guess.
Yeah. It's less than Stadia.
And I've also got, I've got 2 15-foot USB extenders coming out of the PC as well. One for the Xbox One controller dongle.
Okay.
And one for a Logitech kind of all-in-one trackpad keyboard.
Oh, nice.
Doohickey, which they're $30. They're everywhere. And I was going to say, I think I read when I bought those that 15 feet is about the practical limit for unpowered USB.
Yeah,
before you start getting degradation.
But you can do a hub there as well and keep make them go a long way.
And then the last thing, just real quick, the thing I did was I just Velcro tied all those cables together.
You made a snake.
So it coils up nice and neat and is super easy to roll out and lay back behind the PC.
What's funny is in the 360 days, the old 360 dongle, the range on that thing was exceptional. I don't know if you remember, but like
the big fat one?
Yeah,
it was like a
round one with a...
It wasn't that big, but compared to now, it's like a tiny little USB thumb drive looking thing.
Yeah. But back then, that thing I could use, I would plug it in my computer. I would just use that in the living room. And I literally have like my network ports are back to back, like the living room one and the office one face each other. So I just popped a plug out in there and just ran an HDMI cable through the hole.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was only like, it was like 8 feet long. It totally reached the TV. And then I would just use the gamepad.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Through the wall.
That's the dream.
But the Xbox One one doesn't penetrate the wall as well, or it doesn't go through the TV as well.
Huh?
So, cause it uses Wi-Fi Direct and it just never worked right.
Interesting.
So, I had to, that's why I started using the Steam Link actually. Okay.
That's interesting to hear because I've had not the best luck with the signal quality as well. Or I guess
on the Xbox,
specifically with the audio. Do you ever plug headphones in?
Never.
Really?
No. I do on the Steam Link and it works fine.
Okay. So like on the PS4, I know that's Bluetooth. That's a totally different standard.
Yeah.
But like I plug headphones into the PS4 controller and it's been nothing but perfect for 8 years or 7 years or whatever. But I cannot get good audio out of an Xbox controller. I've tried multiple controllers. It just breaks up. Like crackles, like drops very sporadically.
I wonder if you plugged a USB hub in the middle of that 15-foot cable, it would do it. No.
This is even to the console that's 6 feet in front of me. This is both using the PC dongle and directly to an Xbox One. Like the audio has just always been terrible for me, no matter what.
Do you have one of the second-gen Bluetooth Xbox controllers?
Yes. This is using both generations that have had the
Bluetooth?
The headphone jack built in.
I bet if you did it with the Bluetooth one, it would be fine. Because I play Steam Link on the... So I bought Bluetooth Xbox controllers for Steam Links because I was tired of plugging in Xbox 360 dongles and having to keep a fourth controller around to do PC games in the living room and the bedroom. And it works fine on the Bluetooth, but I could never get it. Like, getting the Xbox wireless dongle working with the Steam Link was always a hassle.
Yeah, I just... Giving up and buying something else just makes me grouchy, though.
I'm grouchy anyway.
I refuse. I can't.
That's the more responsible choice.
I don't know, man. That's like a 6 foot distance from the couch to the Xbox. I don't know why it's so bad, but anyway.
Yeah. Maybe the Xbox is just bad, Brad.
Possible. Well, we're in luck. There's a new one coming out soon.
You have a 360 under your TV still.
I mean, I have an extra shelf.
Okay.
Might as well
there's
put something
there. Yeah.
If anyone listening can think of a better alternative than a 360 on my extra entertainment center shelf,
I dug out
I'll
a 360
entertain suggestions.
I dug it out to play Rock Band the other day.
Yeah, right. Like there's still games that have not made the jump.
Yeah.
So
Rock Band 3 is way better than Rock Band 4. Rip Rock Band.
Shots fired.
Yeah, I know. Hot takes.
All right.
Yeah.
Josh from Brooklyn. I recently built a new PC and ended up buying an AMD Ryzen 3700X CPU. In previous builds, I had discounted AMD as a budget choice rather than a competitor, but this time around, AMD is now a direct competitor and even a leader to Intel. What changed that their chips are now so much more competitive? Was it architectural changes, or had I just discounted them due to word of mouth? I mean, my understanding is they have gotten a lot better. Like, they were definitely kind of out of the running in the performance market for a while, right?
So,
like, the heyday of AMD to me was late 90s to... I guess like 2020. Yeah. Like the Duron Athlon era was the, like, I bought nothing but AMD for like 10 years. And then in 2010, I went back to Intel.
We put an Athlon on the cover of Maximum PC for the first time in like probably 2004, maybe 2003.
Yeah.
Cause they hit a gigahertz before Intel did.
Right. And then I don't really know what happened in the intervening decade. Cause I got back on Intel and kind of stopped paying attention.
So part of it is that, like, part of the challenge with this stuff is that if you make the wrong bet,
it takes a long time to course correct.
It takes a long time to course correct.
Like, that's the problem Intel is having now, right?
Well, that's the problem Intel had during the Athlon days, is they were betting on clocks on Pentium 4 reaching ridiculous clock speeds and having a really deep pipeline. And then that bet didn't pay off because they weren't able to hit the clock speeds they needed for the deep pipeline to work.
Yeah.
And then they had to rejigger their whole thing for massively multi-core.
Right. And that takes years.
Yeah. And AMD bet that multi-core was going to be a big deal, but then it took them a while, both for the software and the compilers, to catch up with the number of cores they were putting out. And also, the big problem AMD always has, both on graphics cards and CPUs, is that the perceived default in the industry that people develop on is Intel and NVIDIA. So, like, there's always weird shit that happens around the edges.
That was actually one of the things that pushed me away from that platform, was like, it was super cost effective. I know I've said it before, like, when you were a broke college student just trying to run Quake faster, like, overclocking that thing 50% was a huge thing.
Yeah.
But there were always issues around, like, motherboard chipset drivers and RAM that were, like, you know, the memory controller didn't like the timings on your RAM, and you had to tweak the hell out of that stuff to make it stable.
Like, it had shitty 64-bit performance.
Yes.
So,
like, there's these little idiosyncrasies that just made it kind of a pain in the ass to deal with. It sounds like that stuff has mostly gotten better, but I think, like, memory compatibility is still an issue. I still see motherboard manufacturers putting out, like, approved lists of memory.
Every motherboard does that.
Well, I guess
every motherboard comes with a list of approved DIMMs.
Well, that's fair. Okay. But it seems like it's still maybe more of an issue on that side.
Well, so as I understand it, the thing with I haven't built a Ryzen system yet. I should do that this year, actually. But the thing with Ryzen, as I understand it, is that it's very sensitive to memory timings. Mm-hmm. So
that's what I've heard.
Performances. So if you get the wrong memory, you'll see a pretty significant hit on your performance versus getting the good memory. which you'll see. Is this, are we talking about chiplets? Do you want to talk about chiplets?
Yeah, we should get there eventually. Okay. Yeah, for sure.
So the thing that AMD did with Ryzen that's really neat is in the early days of multi-core design, like the pre-core, I guess, what's Intel's core? Yeah, pre-core, multi-core Intel CPUs. They just took two Pentiums and glued them together on a chip, and then they talked to each other across the North Bridge. So, like, in order...
Two discrete pieces of silicon on the same package?
Two discrete pieces of silicon on the same package.
Okay.
That were talking to each other like through the memory bus of the CPU, basically.
Probably like underneath a shared heat spreader or something. Like yeah. not visible.
It looked like one chip right. when you were plugging it in, but it was two cores.
That's what I mean.
And there were problems with that in that the two cores couldn't like pass data back and forth at CPU speed. They had to pass it across at memory speed, which is a lot order of magnitude slower. So they couldn't even, then they switched to designs that used like shared cache. So like they could speak across the L3 cache or L4 cache or whatever. And that was a lot faster and that was better. And that's where like all the Nehalem on stuff started. That's when multi-core started to get really good.
This was still before you had multiple cores on the same die, though?
This was when you started getting multiple cores on the same die.
That is that?
Yeah. Okay. So then the problem with putting multiple cores on the same die, though, is that if you have, say, four cores on a die and three cores will run at the desired clock speed of that CPU and one won't, you can't sell a tri-core CPU and they maybe didn't want to sell... You know, this is where like the 6600 and all those kind of $300 hexa-core parts come from, is they make a bunch of massive core CPUs for servers and stuff like that. And the ones that don't bin at the speed that the ones that don't test right at the speed that they're going to run, that they're trying to sell, they'll just spin down and sell for $300 to people who want to make videos on their PCs or whatever.
Right. I would, not to digress too much, but yeah. We probably would need an expert in here to get a whole episode out of this, but I would spend a whole hour asking questions about microchip fabrication. Like I bet
Lloyd Case would come on and talk to us.
I find that whole process to be completely fascinating, from like the clean room aspect of having to go in there in what looks like a hazmat suit, to the idea of yield being variable and like not knowing how good the chips you get off of your wafer are going to be and what causes those issues. Because my limited understanding is that those problems are happening at like the atomic scale at this point.
Sometimes. Yeah. It can be like not a fingerprint, obviously, but like the equivalent of a tiny imperfection
right.
in the silicon wafers they get are like 99.9994% pure. Right.
right.
So it's the 0.006%.
Right. If you're unlucky and you get one of those where that impurity existed, like one tiny, almost microscopic spot where the current doesn't quite flow properly, you're screwed.
Or like, I would assume it's like a dust mote flies in right. between the laser and the wafer when right. it's etching apart, or, right. you know, like we're talking about things that are nanoscale
yeah.
constructions. Yeah. So yeah, it doesn't take a whole lot to mess them up.
Yes. That stuff is fascinating to me, but anyway, I don't mean to interrupt.
It's funny. One of the guys in my Twitch chat works in a silicon fab.
Well,
I don't know who's, I wouldn't say if I did, but like the number of toxic chemicals, like there's a chemist and stuff that are in the chat on the reg. And he's talking about shit that everybody else is just cringing. Like hydrofluoric acid is some of the scariest shit on earth. Yeah. And he's like, oh yeah, we got in the chilled hydrofluoric container the other day, and there were
barrels of it,
icicles of hydrofluoric acid.
Yikes.
Yeah. Terrifying.
Yikes.
Anyway. So yeah, the chiplets, let them break out with, I think third gen, they started doing DRAM and IO on one like center core chip.
Yeah.
And
then, like, if you ever see a picture of the package of the current Ryzens, it's like one, it's kind of one big chip in the middle and then a bunch of little satellite.
Yeah.
Chiplets, they call them, around the edges.
So instead of putting those CPU cores on a monolithic piece, one piece of silicon, they do them separately. And what that means is that then they can test each of those cores individually, so they can bin more efficiently, which means that like the CPUs that run at the desired speeds end up all together, and the CPUs that are slower end up all together. So it's much more efficient, and that means that they can sell the CPUs cheaper,
right? Like that's
how they're more capable.
I assume that's how you see like the Threadrippers and so forth out there that are yeah. offering two or three times more threads than Intel for the same price.
So the thing that changed is that the technologies that let us do the CPU, the inter-package communication, got much better.
You're talking about kind of the interconnect between like the individual
yeah.
chips.
Yeah. Because like in that old core days, they had to go out at memory bus speed, which was like 2400 megahertz or something like that back then. It was slow. Now they can communicate. There's L3 on the chiplets, on the CPU core chiplets, but they can communicate with the other chips across the DRAM and IO bus on that big chip in the center of the package. And it seems to be very efficient.
Yeah, that seems like a smart design. The one other thing I've seen, and I only know very little about this, but it sounds like, and I know like die size is not everything, but I think AMD has been on 7 nanometer for a while, and it seems like Intel is still somehow struggling to get there.
I mean, the process reductions, as I understand it, haven't made as much of a, like, as you get closer to the theoretical limits of what we can do, the improvements aren't as good as they were going from like 35 nanometer to 17 nanometer. 35 millimeter. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Micrometer to 17 micrometer.
Yeah. But
like you're still seeing process. Like my understanding is that the general feeling is that Intel is in a better spot because they have headroom on process where AMD doesn't necessarily anymore. Hmm. But the thing that's interesting about those Ryzen chips out, it's, we talk about chickens and eggs a lot here. But having these CPUs that are mass market CPUs now with 16 and 32 cores is going to make the applications that care about performance pay much more attention to threading, which I hope will come down to games at some point.
That seems better for everybody in the long run. Because it seems like when I look at game benchmarks, it seems like single threaded performance is still the thing that matters there, and that seems crazy in light of these multi core consoles having been around for so long.
Well, so you see people dump things that aren't performance gates. What that means is that the bottleneck is always going to run on a single core.
Okay.
Right. So like if the bottleneck is triangle, this is a bad example because it's not a real one, but triangle setup for your 3D scene, and that's going to determine what the rest of the frame rates are. So it doesn't matter how fast the sound process running on a different thread and the physics process running on a different thread and the AI process running on a different thread run because they have plenty of excess cycles.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, look, everything about PCs and computers in general is shifting bottlenecks around.
Sure.
So.
Seems to be the way.
But yeah, Ryzen seems good.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm probably another year or two away from a new build, but AMD is back in consideration for me for the first time in a decade.
I think,
which is nice to see. Like, it's nice to see competition in the CPU space again.
Yeah, I just rebuilt my desktop PC this last year. But my stream PC, the PC that runs my Twitch stream, is 3-4 years old now.
That would be a great place for
more
cores.
I would love to rip some threads there.
That's a workload that would really directly benefit from it.
But that's the thing is like put 32 cores in that thing and turn OBS all the way up and let's see what happens.
Yeah. I will say real quick, just if you're thinking about an upgrade soon, like, yes, I know there's always something to wait for in computer hardware, but they're about to move to Zen 3, which is their next like big micro architecture shift.
Yeah.
And they're talking like that's going to be a massive efficiency improvement.
In terms of power?
Over Zen 2? No, in terms of instructions per clock.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like they're talking like 15% plus.
Huh.
So.
Interesting.
And that's, I believe, next year's chips are going to be the first ones on that.
Okay.
So that might be worth keeping an eye on.
The other thing that's nice about AMD is that generally they keep motherboard chipsets longer than Intel does.
Yes. I've noticed. I've seen people talking about like they've got an AMD motherboard from like two generations of chip ago that they just bought the new chip and threw in there.
Yeah.
Like, that is almost unheard of
in a world where
Intel
has done two generations of chipset for the current socket.
Yeah.
It is nice that they continue to support stuff for a long time.
Yes, that is nice for sure. Here's an email from Brian, which is just a link to a CNET review for the new TCL 8 series.
Oh yeah, the 8 series.
And his email underneath the link just says, "Hey, look, mini LED. I miss Windows Phone." That's the entirety of the email.
Is this the, have we reached the bottom of the barrel?
I don't think we're going to talk about Windows Phone here unless you especially want to. The email is much more about the TV.
I liked playing Hexen or Hexic.
I liked getting achievements on the, I kind of didn't hate the Windows Phone. There were some good ideas in that interface. Like the live tiles were pretty neat.
If they had rolled Windows Phone out when Android launched, we would be in a very different situation now.
Like as opposed to what did happen? Was it after?
It was 2 years late.
Okay.
Like they shipped that. Like Android was starting to ship in 2009 and didn't get real until like 2011 or 2012.
You really think they could have captured
Yes.
More of the market?
100%.
Really?
Yeah. Think about how weird it was to buy a computer from Google in 2009.
All right. Sure.
Yeah. Huh. So a bunch of weirdos and, you know, open source perverts buying Android phones back then.
Nick. What is this, Linux?
Yeah. We don't want to, like, look. Yeah. Anyway, I'm joking, obviously, but that was a real thing.
Yes. Anyway, to get to the actual point of the email, he just links to this CNET review of the new TCL 8 series.
Is this a TV?
Yeah, it's their new line of TVs.
Okay.
Reviews by David Katzmeier, who, to be fair, I work for the same company.
Okay.
But I have always found his TV reviews to be amazingly thorough.
I would say that he's right up there with like Robert Herron and some of those guys who've been doing this for a really long time and are very good at it.
If you really want to know about all of the inner workings of the TV, it's a fun read.
I'm surprised that Wirecutter never hired him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He seems very good from what I've seen. Anyway, I wanted to bring it up because I don't know if we talked about this during our screens episode a few weeks ago.
Well, we talked about micro-LEDs.
Micro-LED is a very different thing from mini-LED.
So micro-LED is when you, instead of having like a screen, like the LEDs are just the screen. It's like a Jumbotron. That's small in your house.
Micro-LED is OLED, except potentially cheaper to
just
make.
Just LEDs.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same kind of tech. I think it's mostly down to the types of materials used in the manufacturing and stuff like that, because the OLEDs use organic compounds.
Yeah.
And the micro-LED does not. Anyway.
So what's a mini LED?
Mini LED is, remember last time how we complained about the marketing effort around quote LED TVs?
Oh yeah. Do you mean LCDs with an LED backlight?
And how they're actually just LCDs, which is an ancient technology.
Well, hold on. They're LCDs where you can turn on and off the backlight selectively. Yeah. Usually, which is a good
thing. That is a good thing. They're better than old LCDs.
Yeah.
But they're still LCDs.
Yeah.
Like they're not, I mean, come on. You know what the point of calling them LED TVs is?
Sex cells.
Yes, exactly.
What's in a mini LED,
Brad? So a mini LED. So
are they just smaller LEDs behind the LCD screen?
Basically that and more of them, but like an order of magnitude more. I think it's interesting. If you look at this review, there are some diagrams in here that make it pretty fascinating to look at. Like this, the visual that goes along with this, like, I think is really cool.
Do they talk about LEDs per pixel?
They're not quite at that point yet, but it's getting closer.
I want one to one, one LED per pixel.
They're nowhere near that yet.
That's a micro LED TV, I guess.
I guess to put it in perspective, like cheapo LCDs only have backlights around the edges of the screen, and they've got like what, some kind of filament stretched across the screen to carry the light.
Yeah.
Then you get like nicer LED TVs have the LEDs pointing at you right through the screen.
Okay.
But you still only get like on the order of like hundreds of LED individual LEDs at best. And then you're familiar with local dimming.
Yeah. Local dimming is the thing that makes LEDs not LCD TVs not look like they have blown out blacks.
Right. Like they dim specific LEDs based on what's on the image. So you're not blowing out the dark parts of the scene.
Yeah.
This is basically that, except times.
They also make the credits unreadable usually.
Right. Like credits are the thing I've always heard where like, oh, you get an ugly halo effect around the text, right? Like,
or the text is so dim you can't. Right. I had to turn it off. I had this on my Vizio TV. I just turned it off because it annoyed me.
I guess the easiest way to explain this is if you picture the backlight of like a few hundred LEDs behind your TV,
okay,
they're increasing the resolution on that backlight.
Oh,
so it's tons. It's like thousands of tiny LEDs instead of only a few hundred bigger ones.
That sounds nice.
So what they're doing is backlighting. They're creating a backlight image that roughly corresponds to the actual image on the screen,
as opposed to using OLED where it just doesn't emit light if it wants to show black.
Like that. I mean, that is obviously a superior technology.
It's kind of the same price, though.
Yeah, that's the thing. These things launched at a pretty steep price. Hopefully it'll get cheaper, or maybe OLEDs will just continue getting cheaper and this won't be an issue in 5 years.
Oh, this is always a good sign of a review that launched on December 20th. And he says at 6:43 a.m., 4 hours after the review was published, the price was dropped $400.
Yes, they dropped the price.
Jesus.
Because I believe he criticized the price in the original review.
I mean, that seems right.
Anyway, I mean, it won't play on the podcast, but if you go check out his review, which probably shouldn't be too hard to find, there's a link to kind of an explainer about mini LED or mini LED.
Oh, that's interesting.
And you basically can see, he kind of shows you a visualization of what the backlights look like. And the backlight on an old LED TV is just a big smeary black and white mess, versus the backlight on a mini LED TV is kind of like
looks like a low res black and white.
It's a pretty close, fuzzy approximation in black and white of the actual image you're seeing.
So, I want nano LED, Brad.
I mean, we might be getting there. I don't know.
It's like micro LED, but even smaller.
Yeah. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting because, I mean, you know, the upshot is he said it is the nicest looking LCD on the market.
I miss Windows Phone 2, Brian.
Yeah. So there you go.
You know, Windows Phone had headphone plugs, part of the spec.
That's only because it didn't have time to get rid of them.
Well,
it wasn't around long enough.
They didn't care about being thin. They just wanted to be awesome.
That's right. Let's see. I have a Star Trek question here, and I'm trying to find it. Whoever sent in the Star Trek question.
I want a
labeled their email question.
Oh, nailed it.
Making it hard to find. Here it is. It's from Tom.
Hi, Tom.
I've been watching Star Trek The Next Generation, and I was wondering what staple Star Trek tech, such as transporter, warp drive, replicator, etc., you think we are closest to realizing, and which ones are the least likely to ever come into being?
Pads.
Pads?
Pads.
Like the iPad looking thing? Like,
the pad. The personal.
Oh, that's right. They are. That is the actual acronym.
PAD. PADD.
Right. Yes.
I don't remember what the acronym is for.
I am a bad Star Trek fan. I forgot about that.
Damn it, Brad.
Despite owning a copy of the TNG technical manual.
I had that when I was in high school.
Yeah. I didn't have it. I sat on the floor in the Walden books and read it over and over.
Oh, man.
And then Walden. I got a copy much later in life. Anyway. Yeah. I mean, those things are basically iPads, right? Like.
Yeah, we're there. We have
kind
it.
Of all they are.
They're see-through, though, which is cool.
Oh, that's right. They were.
Weren't they? Or no? Maybe they weren't.
Maybe not. I forget.
I feel like in the movies, they're probably see-through.
That might be right. They had a higher budget.
Yeah.
There. I feel like the tricorder is kind of realistic.
There are medical devices now that are like that.
Right.
You can buy an ultrasound that is like looks like a handheld thing.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about it before. You've talked especially about handheld like kind of collectors for different kinds of particles.
Oh, yeah.
And like radiation detectors.
Yeah.
Like we're not that far off from a device that can scan for all kinds of like physical anomaly.
Probably something that does everything. We're pretty far.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's probably.
But like you can have a box full of things that'll scan for all the things that a tricorder does.
Like component versions of that technology exist, right?
Yeah.
They just haven't been all thrown together yet.
I'm trying to think. I don't think warp travel and impulse engines and transporters. Those aren't going to happen in the time that we're going to care about them.
Probably not. I feel like the replicator and holodeck is probably the least feasible.
I think holodeck...
Because it relies... I mean, at least in that fiction, it relies on basically space magic.
Yeah, but...
Like, they just early on, they trot out the fact that they've discovered that matter and energy are easily interchangeable. And that seems kind of far-fetched.
Well, that's only interchangeable because they have infinite power.
I guess.
I feel like... I feel like we'll get to a point where you can have a holodeck-esque VR experience.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about, in that fiction, they literally replicate actual matter that you can touch.
Yeah, no, I know. It's not, I think what we'll do is have an approximation of what that touch would feel like, not,
oh, sure.
Not the actual creation of the matter.
Through like a weird motorized bodysuit or like more like
probably
a neural link?
I think probably a bodysuit that stimulates nerves directly.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's what I've seen implies that that's probably more likely than putting a spike into the back of your skull.
That's
I'm not going to buy a version one of the brain spike.
This is not a Verhoeven movie.
No. Yeah, I think that's good. I think that's right.
Yeah.
I don't think food replication. I like making food.
I guess. I mean, would you really turn down a replicator, though?
I mean,
if it was an option.
Depends on how the food is. You know, I went back and rewatched Force Awakens and Last Jedi before the new Star Wars came out, which we're not going to talk about in this context at all.
Yes. Are you going to talk about one quarter portion?
No. Oh. I'm going to talk about the scene in Force Awakens when Rey gets the food
and she puts the water in it.
Yes, yeah.
When he gives her. Yeah.
That is the coolest practical effect in all of those movies. That's pretty neat. I think.
Yeah.
Cause that's a real thing. It's a practical.
Oh, wow.
And
it looks very convincing.
I've talked to a couple of people who worked in effects stuff since I saw that again. I was like, hey, do you know how they did that? They're like, no, I don't know how they did that.
Nobody's figured that one out.
I mean, I'm sure it was in Cinefx or something, but
yeah,
I don't know how it was done. It was cool.
Yeah.
I would buy that technology. I bet we can get that technology. The one quarter portion technology.
I think so.
I don't know. Maybe
blue bread. I don't think doesn't
better than the blue milk, man.
Sound very appetizing to me personally. It's a no go on warp travel for you.
Look,
I mean,
NASA has the Department of Warp Travel.
Yeah.
But every time you talk about that, then people who work at NASA are like, those guys are cranks. Don't listen to them.
How the hell do they get funding?
Yeah. I think it wouldn't surprise me if we send a like laser powered probe, like a Charlie Strauss kind of space magic laser powered probe to like Alpha Centauri or something like that in our lifetime.
Wow.
Because if you think of it, like you do laser sales, you can continue accelerating them all the way. You can decelerate them when you get to the other side.
Sure.
Like it could be something that leaves before we die, but probably doesn't arrive before we die.
Sure. And then you just have to wait, 4 years to get any data back?
Yeah. And also the 200 years it'll take to traverse the distance.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Let's see. Guillaume wrote in.
Okay.
And said, the tech giants claim their cloud data centers are carbon neutral. Is that really true? How green is our cloud future?
So carbon neutral in this case is talking about the power consumed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can be carbon neutral today if I buy my electricity from a carbon neutral provider in the Bay Area.
Oh, sure. Like they offer that choice, actually.
Yeah.
It's split out on our bill. In fact, I paid our power bill right before this.
Yeah.
And I forget how they phrase it, but you have like the bulk of the bill is just sort of standard power. And then there's some itemized line that's like,
you can buy wind power from someplace.
They don't say what kind of power it is, but they imply that it's like third party green power.
Yeah.
That's being added into the grid that you're paying for. And I think you pay more for it.
Well, and like in the old days, you could buy internet from COVAD across AT&T's lines. They leased lines from AT&T, or you can buy Sonic internet from across AT&T lines in certain parts of the Bay Area now.
Right.
You can buy green power that's generated greenly.
Right.
And it's transferred across PG&E's network.
Yeah. I mean, the bigger question though is how power efficient are those data centers? How much are they actually using? Because power generation and usage is a zero sum situation, right?
Well, I mean,
like the more power they're using, the less available power there is for other applications that are perhaps less frivolous.
But at the same time, like there's very little storage built into the power grid right now. So like whatever is being generated at any given moment is also being consumed at that same moment.
Okay, that's fair.
So like if they have solar panels on the roof of their data centers that are generating all the power needed for the data center, that's neutral as far as I'm concerned.
Okay,
yeah. I mean, does it account for like the spin up cost of making that hardware and then, you know, parting it out when you're done and getting the panels online? All that? Probably not.
Heat dissipation
usually goes straight into rivers. It's fine. The fish love that. It makes the eggs extra hardy.
All right, Will, last email. It's from Nick in Chicago.
Okay.
Are you ready for this?
Hit me.
Okay. I upgraded to an NVMe SSD for my gaming computer over Black Friday, and I've been thinking about the PS5 and Series X's claims about SSD performance. Are the things they're talking about available to current SSD owners on PC? Is the tech that much different than current SSD capabilities? Specifically, the claims about being able to reduce game sizes by a huge amount, dramatically lowering loading times, fine-grained access to what data is installed, etc. All of these things sound super cool for someone who games mostly on console and little on PC. The Wired Reveal article even talks about taking advantage of these huge changes to change the way games are developed, removing Mass Effect elevators and the like. Can games really be designed with these SSDs in mind if the PC hard drive still exists?
I think that, yeah, I mean, so the big thing about designing for SSDs is that you assume that the defaults are SSDs.
Right.
And not just that the defaults are SSDs, but that, like, that's what it's going to run on, and it's never going to run on a spinning platter.
Right. Yeah, and that's been the big question to me about how they're going to handle PC ports in this new console era.
My bet is if you look at Steam survey data, you can assume that people have SSDs now.
You think so?
Yeah, they've gotten cheap enough. Like, when you can get a 2 terabyte drive for under $200, like, there's no reason not to get an SSD for your PC at this point.
And at that point, I mean, that literally becomes a line item in the hardware requirements on the game on Steam, right?
Yeah.
It's like, must have an SSD.
That's exactly it.
But again, though, even these newer NVMe drives are dramatically faster than your old SATA 3 SSDs. So, like,
they're not that dramatically faster. The difference is that the throughput is the memory performance and not the interface, right? This is the bottleneck episode this week. But you're looking at... a change from millisecond to nanosecond access time from a physical disk to an SSD. And like the throughput is important, but really the access time, like the random access time, is the thing that's the big deal on SSDs.
Yeah, that may be the case. I mean, unless you get a game that is just like hyper designed around streaming assets at a certain speed.
Well, Spider-Man is the perfect example, right? Like they based the core game mechanic of swinging through the world based on the access time for the hard drive and the PS4.
Right. So that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. It seems like if they're making a multi-platform game that'll have to sell on PC, they might have to be a little more conscious of that sort of thing.
But I really think they're just going to say, hey, you have to have an SSD and they'll base it. Like if the difference between a load, like a slightly longer load time on, say, an NVMe PCI Express SSD versus a SATA 6G SSD is going to be like the difference between like a fast hard drive and a slow hard drive, not the difference between an SSD and not an SSD.
Yeah. Even though like the stated maximums on those interfaces are massively different.
But still, the flash memory isn't that much faster than SATA 6G.
That's what I'm saying, like the on paper in some cases. Yeah.
So I mean, I'm interested in seeing, it's kind of like Stadia, right? Like I'm interested in seeing what people do with when the constraints change, when the bottlenecks move. And like with Stadia, you have infinite compute and like low latency from the machine to the data center to the server. But then there's high latency from the renderer to the controller and the eyes. So like it's weird when that stuff changes. It presents interesting opportunities for game developers.
Yeah.
And yeah, I want to play Spider-Man where you can swing it like 300 miles an hour down the...
they should put that out.
Make a spider paste
they should
out
just
of yourself.
Put that out as a tech demo.
Yeah.
Just to be like, hey, look, it works. All right. I'm going to call that the last email.
That sounds like a good last email.
Yeah. Thanks for writing in, everyone.
Yeah. If you have emails, we do these once a month. The email address is techpod@content.town. And I guess that'll do it for us this week.
All right.
Man, I wish I was playing Half-Life Alyx.
Yeah. I'm excited to see that.
Me too.
Did you just get to play the first part over and over on different headsets? Is that how they did it?
I played the first 3.5 hours of the game.
Oh, wow.
Because they wanted us to get comfortable with mechanics.
It's
like learning how to throw and stuff with it and how to reload the guns and stuff to the point that you could do it reliably in a fight.
Muscle memory.
And then, yeah, and then the section that we replayed over and over again was like a 20-minute section. Okay. Once you kind of got into the real combat portion of the game.
I mean, I don't know how long that game is, but that sounds like a pretty big chunk. I
think they said like 10 or 15 hours.
Yeah, that sounds like
it's like a quarter.
Pretty solid chunk of that game.
Yeah, I played a little bit more while Norm was interviewing people and got through like the 1/3 mark, they said, basically. Headcrabs are, it's way scarier in VR.
Yeah, I bet they are, because I feel like in the old games, they're a little bit comical. There's something a little bit goofy about the head crab. As much as it's trying to be the facehugger from Alien, which is one of the most horrifying things in the history of cinema.
Yeah, when one of the scientists is wearing like a head crab that's been de-beaked as a hat,
yeah,
it tells you how they felt.
Yes.
Like,
I feel like the head crab is sort of the joke version of the facehugger.
I always thought of Half-Life as like an exploration and shooting game and not really a scary game.
Yeah.
Raven Home aside.
Yes.
And this was very scary compared to previous and like just because the combat's more physical, it's kind of slows it down a little bit, which was not necessarily a bad thing. I feel like people who maybe are bad at shooters will be better at this.
Huh. Okay. So, that's an interesting direction for them to go.
Yeah.
Cool.
I'm excited to play more.
Yes. I'm excited to record another episode next week.
Yeah. Well, so, I don't know what we'll talk about.
I've got some ideas.
Okay. Well, I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
See you all next week. Hey, we haven't said this in a while, but if you like the podcast, chucking a review on iTunes helps us a lot.
Algorithmically, it helps.
And it turns out telling your friends helps. When I posted my game of the year list at giantbomb.com, people were like, holy shit, Will and Brad are doing a podcast? I was like, yes, Brad and Will have been doing a podcast. We tweet about it every week. So you can follow us on Twitter.
You're saying it's not enough to just do the thing? You have to promote yourself?
We have to promote it a little bit, I guess. Okay. I'm at Will Smith on the Twitters.
I'm at Brad Shoemaker.
We'll see you guys next week.